Hello, welcome to Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. I'm Rosie Swash, and coming up on this week's show, she's the pop singer slash DJ from Blackpool who's been described as Blondie meets Grime. We talked to Little Boots about her weird instruments and being a nerd. Dorian Linsky and Tim Jones join me for Singles Club, where we'll be listening to and discussing the likes of Amanda Palmer, Tony Christie and James Yorkston. And 80s dub rock, anyone? Observer Music Monthly editor Casper Llewellyn-Smith is bringing World Domination Enterprises back in our as-yet-unnamed feature about long-forgotten bands. But first...
Fell asleep with stains, caked deep in the knees. What a pain.
Was Hang Me Out to Dry by Cold War Kids. Back in 2006, California's Cold War Kids went from obscurity to blog sensation and wooed fans with their stripped-back, piano-based Americana. Singles like Hang Me Out to Dry, which you just heard, Hospital Beds and We Used to Vacation helped to make their debut album, Robbers and Cowards, a sudden smash. And they're back with a new album and a new single, all of which I've had a sneak preview of, and I was rather taken aback to find a track on there called Every Man I Fall For. Is there something they're trying to tell us? Well, not quite.
The music of it was something that we had in the very beginning stages of writing for this record, and then I was just kind of singing different things over it, just kind of nonsense, and then Matt Averro, the drummer, said, like, hey, did you just say Every Man I Fall For? And I said, I don't know, but that's a great start for this. And so it kind of became the idea of, like, a relationship from a woman's perspective and those kinds of things. I thought, like, yeah, that's probably one of the songs I'm most happy with, I think, lyrically. And
lyrics always come secondary to the music, so when we're writing the music, he just kind of makes up noises or words and stuff.
It's characterization for you a lot of the time. You're singing through someone else's perspective.
Yeah, trying to like evoke the emotion, using the emotion of the song to kind of think about a character through that, yeah.
And are these characters that come to you in your head, are they real people from literature?
They're both, yeah. Song by song, different, sometimes real people, sometimes a movie or literature or something, yeah.
One of the songs off your new album, I don't know if it's going to be the first single, or it's something is not right with
yeah,
it.
That is.
That's a very ominous title.
Yeah.
For something to put up for yeah. your, you know.
It's funny. It's very funny. I like it a lot still.
Is it going to be the first
title.
Single?
Yeah, yeah.
That title came from, we were writing the song, just the music for it, and Nate was tangled up in cords, and his microphone, our microphone stands are like, they have like held together by tape, like the microphone, and you said something's not right with me, and I thought that was like clever.
I like that. So you just, because you're giving me quite vivid descriptions of where you're getting all this stuff from. So what about Loyalty to Loyalty, which is the name of the album?
Where did it come from?
Yeah.
I just kind of came across this phrase, Loyalty to Loyalty, that was coined by this philosopher of the early 1900s, American guy named Josiah Royce, who kind of wrote a paper called Loyalty to Loyalty that was in reaction to kind of like a Nietzsche idea before him that was like the ideal pursuit of man is to kind of rise above everybody else. And Josiah Royce's Loyalty to Loyalty was like kind of say like that even though man's tendency is always to want to rise above everybody else, that you need to like not just loyalty to your like your family or your job or your country, but like loyalty to loyalty itself. So that's kind of simple explanation.
Is it reflective of your experiences together as a band, because you've known each other for a long time?
Yeah, it's reflective of a lot. Like, it's very reflective of the lyrics on this record more than anything else that we've done, but it also is very reflective, I think, like what we're about as a band and what our relationships are like with each other. And
being in a band must, and all the stuff that comes with it, the touring, the relentless schedule, must really put a lot of pressure. Because I see there's all this lovely arty footage of you guys in the studio and you're smiling and the edited version.
Yeah.
You know, what's it really like?
What's it really like?
We just have some honesty to honesty.
We're touchy, but we're not that touchy. I mean,
I think it's honestly because it really comes down to, like, we have lots of other friends in bands, most of which have had their failures in those kind of relational ways. And it's just funny because even though the idea of, like, strife-torn, like, Oasis cliche kind of is so attractive to people, but people really fall into that pattern of being, like, in bands, people really, like, succumb to being, like, selfish and moody and wild and everything.
Because they think it helps them create it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that because they think it's, like, synonymous with what an artist is supposed to be, and it's just silly. I think that we've all become more mature people through learning how to maintain through that stuff.
Coming and going, asleep and awake, in bed at the hospital. Tell me the story of how you ended up here. I've heard it all in the hospital.
So writing for the second album, was it sort of on the road and...
Some of it, yeah. Like, some of the songs came at sound checks. A lot of our songs will come, you know, very quickly, and some of them come over a number of years. Like Relief was in the works for, like, probably 3 years or so. Dreams Will Men Dream, Nate kind of spit out really quickly. But then some of it was literally written to last minute, like, On the Night My Love Broke Through. Like,
Mexican Dogs.
Mexican Dogs.
Pretty fast.
Yeah. Yeah, Mexican Dogs we wrote, like, the day before we recorded it. Like, we came home from a Mexico trip. We're really excited about Mexican dogs down there. They're a different kind of breed. And that goes along with the loyalty theme a lot, the dogs. But yeah, we wrote that and recorded it right away just to capture, like, the spontaneity of it.
The second album for a band is often, I mean, it's slightly different because you've had your EPs and that sort of thing, but there's often a lot of pressure, especially when there's been a lot of hype around the band the first time. Because you had this... sort of the modern curse of the buzz band.
Yeah.
How much attention you paid to that, or you thought, well, we're really going to surpass all that stuff with our second record, or whether it was just not in your mind.
It's like audiences. I've heard artists always say they want to ignore the audience or, like, forget about the audience. I mean, like, or, like, I've heard that about ignoring readers of reviews. It's walking that line where you want to completely engage with your audience at a show. I think shutting them out and ignoring them is the worst thing you can do. But then also paying too much attention can be the worst thing to do as well. Because you want to write music for yourselves and make art in not in a vacuum, but not in a not vacuum. So
there was a space and time where we kind of got our foot in the door. And that was, you know, that had to do with some internet things, and that had to do with us just touring the States, you know, nonstop. And like the band Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, the band Tapes and Tapes, they're both also bands that we toured with a lot that were in a very similar place with us, and you know, it's interesting just to even watch kind of how they think about it and what they want from it. We're still in the incubation period of like, I guess there's the review factor, and then there's also the factor of, like, I don't really know too many people who have heard the record that are not our friends, you know? So it's interesting for, like, people that we know well, you know, our friends, to hear it and be like, oh, it's, you know, it's incredible, it's so great, or something. But then, you know, people that we don't know, how people receive stuff at times can be just the most off-the-wall interpretations of things, which kind of is great, you know, in ways, and it's, like, exciting to be like, how on earth are people going to receive this?
I'm getting over, muddling over. I said, could you just wait to tell me in the morning? Slow it down, and lay it low. Save it for the morning. I know that you would like to change me. Make me stop.
That was Nathan and Matt from Cold War Kids, and their new album, Loyalty to Loyalty, is out next week. Well, I hope you enjoyed that, maybe a little bit more than the band did in patches. But moving on, hello, editor of guardian.co.uk/music, Tim Jones.
Hello, writer of guardian.co.uk/music, Rosie.
Well, we have another guest in the studio here to help us with Singles Club, and it is the esteemed Mr. Dorian Linsky.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
We're both a bit tired, aren't we, for different reasons we were discussing earlier.
Yeah, I'm tired for baby reasons. Oh. Grown-up baby reasons.
Well, we're going to start with your selection first, which is Oasis by Amanda Palmer. That that was Oasis by Amanda Palmer. She's the founding member of Dresden Dolls, a self-described Brechtian punk cabaret group from Boston, which basically means they use theatrical cabaret in their live shows and dress up pretty strange. While the band continue, their last EP was out this May, Palmer's solo career has included directing a musical called The Onion Cellar, and an actually more sizable album discography than her Dolls counterpart. The single Oasis is taken from her latest album, Who Killed Amanda Palmer, and it's been produced by Ben Folds, and it's out this week. Dorian, why did you bring this particular piece of music in?
Well, generally, I think she's a really underrated songwriter because she's not your sort of typical singer-songwriter. She's very sort of, she's quite arch and dark and playful, and I find there's bits of Dorothy Parker and Sylvia Plath in her writing. And she's very good at sort of tailoring the sound to the theme. And here it's about a teenage Britpop fan who goes to a party, gets raped, has an abortion. It's about her relationship with her best friend. And it all takes place in 2 minutes. And the way that the music and the harmonies and this sort of mal rat kind of feel. So it's sort of Avril Lavigne meets Randy Newman. And I just think it's pretty unique.
I am inclined to agree with you. I was never a fan of the Dresden Dolls, never have been. So her solo stuff kind of passed me by. Yeah, I was like, oh yeah, this is a song about getting raped. Okay, now she's having an abortion. I was like, oh my God, it really comes at you huge. And I did feel like you can hear the Ben Folds production in it, which is a good thing. Bringing out the different instruments, different times, and really in a huge way. But I have to say, it's the kind of thing that I think I'd find very quite difficult to listen to at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could probably say that about the whole album. But then I find that some of the, you know, the most interesting songwriters, you know, where they are dealing with quite sort of dark stuff, it's spiky. Her voice, particularly on some of the other songs on the album, can be quite abrasive. But, you know, it's different. It's not just a woman with an acoustic guitar who sounds nice.
Yeah.
You know, there's a real kind of like dark, bracing imagination there.
Also what you were saying about her voice, because I went and listened to some of the rest of the album, I find her voice to be a real direct mix of feminine and masculine in a way that I really like.
Mm.
She says something I really like about that. Tim Jones, how do you feel?
Well, like you, I never really liked the Dresden Dolls that much. I found it a bit over theatrical. I don't know, a bit forced sometimes. And when I first heard this, I thought exactly the same thing. But I think the lyrics are really great, actually. And I think it's a really kind of quite a moving, touching thing. And it's about, you know, even though it mentions abortion and rape and stuff, it's kind of about fandom. And it's really quite a clever way of getting into that kind of teenage mindset where, you know, getting a letter from one of your favourite bands kind of is more important than some of the terrible stuff that actually happens in your life. So I think it's quite interesting on that level. And it's a funny pop song as well, like DIY Beach Boys harmonies in the background and stuff.
Okay, well, that's Oasis by Amanda Palmer, and that is available to buy right now. Next up on Singles Club, The Only Ones Who Know by Tony Christie.
In a foreign place, the saving grace was the feeling that it was a heart that he was stealing. Oh, he was ready to impress, the fierce excitement, the eyes are bright. He couldn't wait to get away. I bet that Juliet was just the icing on the cake. Make no mistake, no.
That was The Only Ones Who Know by Tony Christie. Tony Christie is the crooner from Conisbrough, a little corner of Our Fair Isles found somewhere between Rotherham and Doncaster that is very near Sheffield. He is, of course, best known for his song Amarillo, recently given a brand new lease of life, whether you like it or not, by Comic Relief. But his credibility has also been given something of a boost in recent years, starting with the track Walk Like a Panther with Pulp's Jarvis Cocker and ending up with current album Made in Sheffield, produced with various Sheffield-based musicians such as Richard Hawley and featuring this, which is a cover of the Arctic Monkeys song Only Ones Who Know. Tim, this is your section. A couple of weeks ago, you also brought in a song by Glen Campbell. Why do you love old crooners?
This is such a weird thing. It's like the minute we had to start bringing our own songs, I brought in Glen Campbell and Tony Christie. I don't know who it's going to be next week.
With a granddad.
I know.
But to be fair, he's covering an Arctic Monkeys song. They're cool.
Yeah,
they're young.
I mean, Amarillo, God, that song has got
probably
to be
one
the most.
Of the
yeah. I don't know. I just found this really moving and I played it and I love that song anyway. But I guess the way Alex Turner sings it, you know, the charm of that song is his accent. And obviously Tony Christie has got none of that in there. But because of that, he hits all the notes in a much more precise way. And it really reveals, I guess, what a beautiful melody it is. And just what an amazing songwriter Alex Turner is, even without the lyrics and even without, you know, his kind of Sheffield accent, I suppose. It's very cheesy, isn't it? But I like it, and I like a few tracks on the album as well. He does Human League's Louise, which is also great.
In a similar style to this one?
Yeah, I mean, they're all... I mean, he does... Some don't work. He does Richard Hawley's Cole's Corner. And, you know, Richard Hawley...
Sounds like that.
Yeah,
anyway.
He's kind of mastered this kind of sound anyway and made it a bit more modern, so I don't think you need a Tony Christie version. But I like this, and even though it is kind of similar to the way Arctic Monkeys did it, I think it just adds that little bit of sheen to it and just makes it sound a bit, you know, a bit unique, I guess.
Dorian, does this redeem Amarillo for you?
I pretend Amarillo didn't exist.
Good.
Because I kind of first got into him when he did Walk Like a Panther, and I think he did one...
Which I think is fantastic.
It's amazing. And he did one or two other songs on that All Seeing Eye album as well, also written by Jarvis Cocker. I think a lot of young bands have a real fascination with crooners. And you had people like Randy Newman and Pet Shop Boys really wanted Frank Sinatra to sing their songs, and he wouldn't because he was kind of a stiff and kind of a dick. whereas as Tony Christie, he's got that sort of that suaveness, that old school class, the voice. And you've got all these songwriters getting really excited, particularly Alex Turner, you know, with Last Shadow Puppets. You know how much he's into all that stuff. And it's like, oh, wow, we can get him to do our songs. Yeah, sometimes you get to the heart of the sort of the melancholy and beauty of some of these songs. And like you say, it sounds like Richard Hawley, basically.
Mm.
So I think it's produced by Richard Hawley.
Mm.
No point in him covering Richard Hawley.
Yeah.
But I think I can really see the appeal. I can see why bands would be sort of queuing up to sort of let him loose on their songs.
I am a big Richard Hawley fan and I love what he does, but I find this sort of resurrection of Christie as postmodern cool, it just feels a little bit kitsch. You know, sometimes when you get older musician involved in projects and you feel sometimes they're being, I don't feel like he's being manipulated by it, but that there's, do they know why it's popular or why people think it's cool or funny? I don't know. I just feel a little bit uneasy with it. And also, this is probably one of the only songs on the Arctic Monkeys second album that I really don't like. And I don't like it anymore for having it sort of stretched out and having all the sounds brought out, even if it's done so in this way.
I do think that the motivations is genuine. I mean, particularly, I believe that Hawley was kind of the driving force, and maybe Jarvis as well. And these are people who would have a genuine love of him as both sort of local Sheffield hero, but also a love for that era of music. And I don't feel that there's any mockery.
It's not like Mike Flowers Pops, is it, I guess?
No.
It's not knowing.
And it's also got the edge, I think, on some of the American ones, like the Glen Campbell record, whereas when an American crooner decides that he's going to do, like, you know, young folks music, it's the hit. And they do, like, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit or you know, something, some terrible, big, inappropriate hit. And here it's really well tailored. You know, he's not doing I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor.
Who did do that? Was it Tom Jones did that, didn't he?
Oh, God.
You see, Tom Jones is like how not to do it.
Tom Jones doing Amarillo, that would probably be the worst thing ever.
That'll probably be my record next week, the way things are going.
Never mind the Hadron Collider. Like, that would actually make the universe fold in on itself.
Okay, so nothing like that. That's Only Ones Who Know by Tony Christie, and it features on the album Made in Sheffield, which is out in November. Next up is Tortoise Regrets Hair by James Yorkston.
A tortoise regrets hair, tortoise regrets hair, fox takes hair. That I'd seen you in the paper marrying some fool, you'd slipped a smile into the pictures.
That was Tortoise Regrets Hair by James Yorkston. He's a Scottish folk musician who's part of the ever-expanding, ever-decreasing, defunct and fully functional Fence Collective. Various members have included Katie Tunstall and King Creosote. It is alleged that John Peel gave Yorkston his big break after hearing demos of the singer's first album, Moving Up Country, following which he signed to Domino Records. His latest album, When the Ha Rolls In, Ha meaning fog, we think, features 10 original songs and also cover versions of Archie Bronson Outfit, Adrian Crowley and fellow Domino signees UNPOC. This is obviously my choice, as I'm the only one left. If Paul McInnes is in the pod, perhaps he'd say, what makes this folk musician unlike all the other folk musicians that are around at the moment? And I feel that with James Yorkston. I first discovered it actually relatively recently, sort of 3 years ago. I was really taken aback by how evocative the weatheredness of his voice is. His songs all have that, I think, and everything that I've listened to since then that he's released has that. And I guess he's just an example of a musician that when I listen to his music, it totally transports me to somewhere else. And that's, you know, everyone's got those bands and those musicians so that you just kind of, oh, every time you listen to it. This is another example of it. It's not that unlike anything that he's done before. And it sticks to similar themes of, you know, the girl he loved is slightly out of the picture somewhere and he's lost her. And he likes to sort of play the grumpy hermit, you know, the world isn't for me character in it. And I don't know how reflective that is of him as a person, but I like it as a storyteller and a narrator in music. Tim, what do you think?
I think it's interesting you said how it transports you, actually, because when King Creosote started releasing records, who's also part of the Fence Collective, I did consider going on holiday to Fife. I was swiftly told that wasn't a good idea. I like a lot of Fence stuff, and I like King Creosote and Pip Dylan and quite a few of the other people. This, I've always struggled a bit with him. I found it a little bit too traditional. I like the kind of slightly depressive sounding voice. Mm. And it reminds me, not necessarily in the sound, but slightly of Arab Strap and stuff, just in how dejected it sounds. And I think into a bit of dejection.
Dorian, do you like dejection?
I like the way that he sounds like he's always either on his way to or on the way back from some sort of remote Highlands pub. Where in my brain, smoking is still allowed.
Yeah.
Lots of old men with briar pipes and stuff. I find that a little new folk, whatever, goes a long, long way. I loved his song 6 o'clock is just way too early. I just thought it was fantastic. But then I don't know what more I kind of want from him. And I find generally a lot of folk stuff, the radical stuff really was done in the 60s, people like Fairport Convention. It was like, but if you take these traditional ballads and then start sounding like the Velvet Underground and this song, that was pretty amazing. And now I think, unless you're bringing in new sounds, I suppose electronic sounds, it's like, well, yeah, okay, I get it. It's a limited appeal. I'm looking for maybe a nice little lyric, a nice melody, but it can't really excite me.
The lyrics are quite, they're not that accessible either, are they?
No. He sort of switches between, every time you think he's telling a story, he starts using quite abstract imagery in it. Quite often talks a lot about the weather and the things that are going on around him, and then suddenly you're right at the heart of this love story. But maybe it doesn't work in this one, but it's my choice and I'm sticking to it. Okay, so that was Tortoise Regrets Hair by James Yorkston, and it's out next week, I believe. Okay, so while we're chatting singles, here's some blog feedback on last week's choices. I wasn't here for last week, so I'm taking everyone's word for it here. Madrid Mike said of Tim Jones's non-old man choice. Is this your heartbreak?
This was when I was very remotely cool.
Okay. Heartbreak. Great to see Heartbreak getting some attention. Been listening to their album this week after it was leaked on the net. It is impressive, and it seems these guys have taken up the baton dropped by Blackstrobe since the departure of Ivan Smag. I'm fully on board that Italo bandwagon too. Some excellent tunes to be found when you get digging. Ramulation piped up and he said, in terms of the singles, Heartbeat was by far the best, I think he means Heartbreak, although any mention of a sort of Hackney scene, especially one that I know is centred around the Dolphin pub, brings me out in a nervous rash. I don't think it's that fair to dismiss them, the Hackney scene. They're not really, are they? It's
how bad must the Dolphin pub be?
I don't know, I don't go there anymore.
You are that.
Anyway, Marky, meanwhile, had this to say about the other single choices of White Denim. You joke around with their biography, but to me, White Denim sound exactly like the band you've described. They might be able to sell their myth to some in Britain, but I'm failing to be enchanted by a band that look like they write their music with the purpose of soundtracking edgy adverts for small cars. Well, that told me and them and everyone else, which brings us nicely to the end of Singles Club, where we have to say goodbye to you, Mr. Dorian Linsky.
Bye, cheers.
Thanks for coming in. So we want your reviews of this week's tracks, and you can do that on blogs.guardian.co.uk/music. And you can tell us what you thought of James Yorkston, Tony Christie and Amanda Palmer, as well as these other tracks which are out to buy now. Annie, My Love Is Better.
Coming like the light, here we go again. First you say you're right, then you take my pen. Cause I'm with your smile, you don't wanna.
Cause you don't know me. Let the spirit move you. Cause we're going.
Roots maneuver. Let the spirit. The feeling. Join with us. Yo Majesty Club Action. Earlier we teased the pants off you with exotic words like Blondie meets Grime and Blackpool. Now we have herself, Victoria Hesketh, aka Little Boots. The bedroom techie found fame on the internet by posting YouTube clips of herself and her technology covering everyone from Wiley to Hot Chip. Meanwhile, her unreleased Joe Goddard remix track Stuck on Repeat did what dance tracks do and set dance floors alight across the country. Well, I met up with her and we got talking a couple of weeks ago when she came into the studio about her love of musical gadgetry, among other things. And we began by discussing the improbably named tool, the Tenorian. Your band members are me, piano, Moog, three Korgs, a Tenorian and a stylophone and lots of tea. Now, I think at least two of those things are made up. And what's really? A Korg and what's a Tenorian?
What's a Korg?
Yeah, I know.
A Korg is a make of instruments. So they mainly make pianos, I think, and synthesizers. I think it's a lie, though. I don't think I've got three Korgs anymore.
Oh.
No, I have, because I've got a new one. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've got a Korg Poly 6, Micro Korg, and an RK100, and a Tenorian. It's like a new instrument that's made of... It's like a sequencer, but it's made of lights. It's a square of lights, and every light
is
a sound.
So that's
Yeah, I play it on videos and things
your
like
new
that.
Toy.
Yeah, my new toy.
So what does it do?
It just makes noises, really. But you put it on a loop, and you can... There's loads of editable... settings on it, and you can just press anything and it will make music, but it kind of opens your mind to, like, the way you interact with it opens your mind to thinking about music and writing in a different way, because it's not like it's got its own sound or it's a new instrument in that way. It's just a sequencer, but because it's visual and you do it with lights and loops, it just makes you think about music in new ways and writing and how you play it and stuff. And I'm really interested in new technology and gadgets and stuff like that, so that's how I got interested in it. And then now I'm going to use it live, and it actually opens up a lot of possibilities live. For electronic music, it stops you using things like backing tracks, so it's really good.
So it does all that in one, and it only looks like the size of your hand.
It's a bit of a toy, though. It's a bit of an expensive toy. There's a lot of possibilities. We've been really pushing it to its limits, and it can do quite a lot.
So you're into gadgets, but are you still composing things on piano or keyboard?
Yeah.
Are you... classically trained?
Yeah, I've been playing since I was 5. I was classically trained, and then I played jazz for quite a long time, and then pop. I've always written since I was a teenager, and so I've really been through quite a broad spectrum of musical training. But it's all good for me, you know. You can't break the rules unless you know them first, I think.
So when did you become interested in gadgets side of it?
I think when I was in college, I used to have a harp. I used to play the harp, and I sold it for a synthesizer. My first Korg, and I just got really interested. I think I was like 17 and listening to things like Yes and Pink Floyd, which is a bit of a dark time, but I got getting really into synths and stuff, because it was a bit embarrassing to play piano. Like, no one wanted a piano in the band. It wasn't very cool, so I got a synth and started playing in a prog rock band for a while. Dark days. And then I've always just been into synths ever since then, really. Just, and I like new technology and sounds and stuff like that, so it's all kind of linked. I've always been a musician since I was really young. I've played in all sorts of bands, but this is my first solo project and the first thing where I've kind of written everything and been involved in every level, so it's quite a new thing for me to be that involved. And the DJing thing I just started doing on the side, but it's actually... opened up a lot of opportunities, and it's been a massive learning curve, because from that I've started doing remixes and mixtapes, and I understand electronic music and dance music a lot more because of playing in clubs and stuff. So it's been a really, really good learning curve, actually. acoustic gigs are just me and the I mean, when I'm with a piano, it kind of relaxes me because I don't have to think about what I'm doing because it's just really natural to me. It's more when I don't have an instrument like a piano, I'll be more nervous, which the new live show, I'm not going to play that much. So I'll be more nervous about that because I feel a bit naked when I don't have a keyboard near me.
Is this because of what you were saying before we were recording about, about female singer-songwriters and their pianos being a bit
nauseating?
A bit gross, was the word
you used. Something a bit gross. I don't know. It's this whole, like, it's that whole kind of Tori Amos vibe. But then I'm definitely, a lot of my teen years were like learning to play Cornflake Girl and stuff, so I'm no stranger. The piano's just something I've been doing for so long that it's just natural to me. But I'm going to try much more and concentrate on the show for the new thing. But we've still got lots of gadgets and exciting stuff. And I just kind of want to do the opposite from your Boys With Guitars setup, really, and lots of visuals and like a whole experience rather than just some kind of indie thing. And one thing I'm trying to do in the live show is take the way we make some of the sounds and stuff. It's still quite a mystery, I think, electronic music to a lot of people. They just think it's on a computer, and a lot of it isn't that we do. You know, we're sampling all sorts of weird things and putting them through stuff. And so trying to take some of the things we do from the studio and take it out of the studio and present it in a visual way to people live so they can see kind of how that happens. And things like the Tenorium does that because it's a sequencer, but it's because it's made of lights. People can see how it's working and connecting visuals to sound. So there's quite a lot of things like that I'm trying to bring out and show people and take to people, you know.
Ask you about Stuck on Repeat, which was the song that sort of brought you to the attention of a lot of people. You came to work with Joe Goddard from Hot Chip. How did he hear about you? How did that song come about?
I'd written the demo just after I'd left my old band or something like that. Someone, like a mutual friend, passed it on to Joe, and I was just, my initial reaction was horror, and I was really embarrassed. I was like, because I, in my head at the time, I was thinking of just being a songwriter, and so I kind of wrote it as a Kylie Minogue type song. And when someone said they sent it to Joe, I was just like mortified. I was like, it's so cheesy, he's just gonna think it's so uncool. And he'd really liked it, and he just started pulling it apart and then kind of put it back together again. And I recorded the vocals on the end of his bed one night, and just one of those things that, looking back, it's probably quite a special little way it all unravelled, but at the time I was just going along with it. And then I put it out anonymously. It's like an 8-minute unreleased song, basically, to have started the amount of things it did. We kind of realised there was something good going on, you know. We've got like a short version now, and I think it'll want to try and get it out to people, more people and stuff. We've just done more things together since then, and it's hard because they're on tour a lot, but we've been emailing each other back and forth ideas, and then he works on stuff and things, and he's just really creative and loves pop music like me, so that's really good.
Absolutely delightful Little Boots. Google her for some YouTube fun, or you can head to myspace.com/littleboots music for some free downloads. Now, our final feature on this week's programme is the aforementioned, unnamed, long-forgotten bands. We still haven't come with a name for it, so if you want to stick one on the blog, then do. I'm going to call it the Who and the What for now. Casper Llewellyn Smith talking to us about his love for the band World Domination Enterprises.
Over the course of the last couple of years, to great hype and media acclaim, lots of my favourite bands from back when I was a teenager have been reforming, groups like the Pixies and My Bloody Valentine. One that's never mentioned from that same late 80s period might just be my favourite of them all, though, World Domination Enterprises. The band were explicitly political. They'd grown out of the same squat culture as their pals, the Mutoid Waste Company, And at a time when those other bands, championed by the Weekly Music Press, were retreating into a kind of blissed-out abstraction, well, Dom couldn't have been more in your face. Keith Dobson made an extraordinarily abrasive noise with his detuned guitar, and Steve Jameson and Digger were the dog-on-a-string version of Sly and Robbie. I love the fact that they covered LL Cool J's I Can't Live Without My Radio, and you could hear that same skewed take on hip-hop, or dub, I suppose, on their best-known tune, Asbestos Led Asbestos. Dayglo Sleeve, to their debut album, Let's Play Domination, is one of the greatest of all time, and gratifying that the record's never been reissued, never made available, as far as I know, on CD. These days, some muppet from Vodafone or Lucozade will be straight on the case trying to co-opt their brand of spunky activism to turn it into something more consumer-friendly. I don't know what became of them, and I sort of hope it stays that way. I don't resent those other bands from my youth reforming and taking home that one big payday. But World Domination Enterprises were always more subversive than that, a grittier, louder version of the French Situationists, and I prefer to think of them as still out there, railing against the system and perceived notions of taste.
For my radio, believe me, I like it loud. I'm a man with a can, I can rock this crowd. I'm kicking down the street to the hardcore beat while my JVC vibrates the concrete. I'm sorry if it can't understand.
Well, that was Casper Llewellyn-Smith. It's nearly time to say bonjour for now, but not before hailing our new Facebook friends, Jimmy Riddle, Annette Lee, Stephen Ellis, Jonathan Leahy Maharaj, John Pile, Alex Simpson. I've been Rosie Swash. You've been Tim Jones.
I have, indeed.
It's been emotional.
Well, that's just me crying to Tony Christie.
See you this time next week, guys.